This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Jude Feld.
Hello everyone, this is Jude Feld and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Horse Racing Radio Network's Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton. We have a very special and honored guest for this edition of Trainer Talk, a man who I've known for nearly 40 years. He was my very first trainer, in fact. A native of Los Angeles who saddled his first winner at Santa Anita in 1974 and has won 1,025 races since then, his trainees have banked nearly $50 million in purses. He trained Alphabet Soup to beat the Great Cigar in the Breeders' Cup Classic. He won Canada's most prestigious race, the Queen's Plate, with Awesome Again, and the Belmont Stakes with Touch Gold, spoiling Silver Charm's bid at the Triple Crown. He has also saddled the winner of the Breeders' Cup Distaff, Adoration, and the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint, Desert Code. I am proud to have Dave Hoffmans on Trainer Talk for the hour. Welcome, Dave.
Well, thanks, Jude. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be talking to you. I miss seeing you out here in California.
Yeah, I'm gonna get out there. Certainly be there for Breeders' Cup and probably the prep races before. Might even have a shot at Santa Anita Handicap Day. So I'll be seeing you relatively soon. We always have a good time when we're together. As a matter of fact, you taught me a lot about wine. I never knew much about wine until I started going out to dinner with you.
That's a necessary evil in my business. You have to drink a little bit to hang in there.
That's right. Yeah, cocktail hour is very important to trainers. No question about it. When you hear those stats about your life, it's pretty impressive. I mean, you know, in golf they say somebody's the best player to never win a major, and I always tell people you're the best trainer not in the Hall of Fame. I mean, you've had a Hall of Fame career.
Well, you know, I guess that's all objective. I feel like I've been doing this for a long time and have won a lot of races, and I don't know. It's not up to me. It's up to some other powers to put someone in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, if my record warrants it, that would be wonderful.
Well, part of my goal of doing this show is to prove to everybody that you deserve to be there. So we'll head in that direction because, you know, my word is gospel. What got you hooked on thoroughbred racing?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in the San Gabriel Valley, and when you do that here in the Los Angeles area, Santa Anita is in your life. You learn how to drive in the parking lot. That's where you learn. My father would take me to the races as a young boy, 6, 7 years old, and then I went to school with a trainer's son, and he introduced me to the backstretch, Gary Jones. He was just inducted into the Hall of Fame, I think last year or the year before, and he got me hooked on the backstretch. And once I experienced that, I never left. That was it. I knew that was it for me.
Is the legend true that Hall of Fame trainer Gary Jones claimed you out of a sandwich shop?
Yeah, that's about right. actually, his dad did. I was going to school and working in an Italian deli in Alhambra. And then I quit that, of course, to go into horse racing.
Do you remember your first winner?
Nui Kali. I remember Nui Kali. He won his first race, a maiden race at Santa Anita with Lafitte Pinkai. Rode him. He won easily. The fact of that is that he won the first race of the day in the filly, or the second. And in those days, you just had the Daily Double with the first and the second. So the filly that won either the first or the second was a filly called Mama Kali, who I ended up buying and I think was one of my first stakes winners. So it was kind of a prolific daily double for me.
Yeah, that's cool. Mama Kali, she was a really nice filly, as I remember. Did the Slough Crew own her? Is that who you bought her for?
I bought her for the Slough Crew from William Hagen Perry. Willard Proctor was training her. And I saw her run in a race at Santa Anita, and I really liked her. She was a sister to Sarsar. I don't know if you remember that far back. It's a long time ago.
Yeah, I remember Sarsar. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this was her sister. So I thought she had some potential, and we bought her, and sure enough, she turned out to be pretty good.
Yeah. Well, we're both California guys, and we go back a long ways. I started going to the races when I was 3 years old. So
yeah, exactly.
I've been going to the races for 55 years, and that's a long time. So I remember a lot of the old horses. So in 1980, you won your first graded stakes with Peregrinator in the San Bernardino Handicap at Santa Anita. That was a grade two. What was that like winning in your own backyard your first graded race?
Oh, that was terrific. That was wonderful. It was a horse I bought from Charlie Whittingham. Whittingham bought the horse in England, brought him over here, and ran him in a few races. And then I bought it from him for a couple of people. But that was fantastic. That was very gratifying because he was a turf horse, and we switched him over to the dirt. And I remember telling Chris McCarron, I don't care if you have to be five or six wide. If this horse gets one pebble in his head, he's not going to run because of the dirt. He hadn't had that much experience. So Chris kept him wide, and he won. That was very, very exciting for me.
Yeah, that's really cool. You buy a horse off Willard Proctor, and when you buy one off Whittingham and win, that's pretty impressive resume right there. Those guys are tough to move up on.
Yeah, well, we got lucky, so that was good.
In case you joined us a little late, we're with David Hoffman's on Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton. By my count, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, maybe you can tell me, but you've saddled the winners of 63 graded stakes. Is that correct?
But I would think about that. I haven't counted it, but I would think so. Maybe somewhere in that area anyway.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what I came up with when I was doing research for the show, and that's a ton of graded stakes.
it's been quite a fun time and gratifying, and you know how frustrating this business can be. And anyone out there who owns a horse knows how frustrating it is. And it's more frustrating for trainers. And we don't show it often, but it's very frustrating business. It's very gratifying and wonderful. But the ups and the downs keep you moving right along, you know. And so to be able to have some success keeps you in the game.
Yeah, that's a theme that we hear often on Trainer Talk. Even if you just have one stakes horse in the barn, it picks up your head. It makes it a lot easier to get out of bed in the morning. But you've certainly had your fair share of good horses. Let's talk about some of those that our listeners around the world probably know. Cat's Cradle, you won the Grade 2 Fantasy and the Grade 1 Acorn with Cat's Cradle. That was for Mrs. Ritter, I believe.
Yes, that was for Ritter Thoroughbreds, Georgia Ritter, and she owned, her best horse I guess she ever owned, well, was Flying Paster, but Alphabet Soup was pretty good too. I purchased Alphabet Soup for her, and we went on to do pretty good with him.
Yeah, he did okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to him in the second hour.
He was a great little horse. I mean, he wasn't the best horse. He wasn't the fastest horse, but he was the most determined horse. I think he won most of a fair share of his races just because of his determination, not because he was the best horse, but because he wanted it.
Yeah, he was a hard trier. He was a very good-looking horse and a kind of a fan favorite because he was gray and because he had kind of a cool name. And a lot of people were Alphabet Soup fans when he was running.
Mm-hmm.
But Cat's Cradle, she's pretty nice filly. You won short and long with her. Talk about her for a minute.
Yeah, she wasn't a very big filly, but she was a cowbred, and she was one of the meanest horses I'd ever trained. She was really, really tough to handle, tough to train, and but she could really run, and she could do anything. She could sprint, and she could go long. I'll tell you a little story about Chris McCarron. I hope he listens to this. I had put Chris on her, and he rode her, I think, two or three times, and he was the only jockey that didn't win on her. So he comes one day, so I took him off, and I put Solis on her, and he won a couple. I put Antley on, and he won a couple. So Chris, the last time he rides her, gets beat. I don't know how she got beat, but she got beat. He comes back, and he said, listen, her neck is so short. Would you put the saddle back 2 inches next time? I said, 2 inches? Are you crazy? I said, I'm putting another jock on this horse.
Somebody with shorter arms.
Yeah. So I kind of tease Chris about it every now and then when I see him.
That's funny. That's a good story. Mm-hmm. Well,
she was a homebred. She was a homebred of the Ritters.
Yeah, the Ritter horses were really tough. I was explaining this to somebody the other day about how they used to have like two fields, one for the colts and one for the fillies, and whoever was still alive at breaking time, they put shoes on them and sent them in. Isn't that kind of the way it was?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It was hard.
They had that wonderful farm in Murrieta. It was on a kind of a hillside, and something with the dirt there, or the soil there, or the, whatever it was, they had repeated runner after runner after runner. They were amazing, the horses that they bred.
Yeah, they raised a lot of good horses, and they were tough. And mm-hmm. a lot of times they'd come in. I remember I was stabled next to Gordon Campbell, and when he was trained for the Ritters, and those horses would come in, and they'd have scars on them and stuff. And
yeah.
And I talked to mm-hmm. Gordon, and I go, "What's the deal?" And he goes, "Oh, he says these are the ones that were still alive when they went to go break
them." Yeah, it was a different era.
Yeah,
it's the same way as children are raised now.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's
kids are pretty entitled and coddled, and in the days when I grew up, you were pretty much on your own most of the time and had to make it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think it's the same thing. But, yeah, those horses were tough, sound horses and strong. And she had another horse maybe people would remember, I don't know, called Rare Gold.
Yeah.
She was a Rahi filly. She won the Landaloose.
yeah, she was a nice filly,
amongst some others.
Yeah.
She was, I'll tell you a quick story about her. I went out, Mrs. Ritter wanted to buy as many Flying Pacer offsprings as she could find. Even though she owned the stallion and bred mares to him, she still wanted more because she loved the horse. So a Flying Pacer filly came up for sale out at Rancho California here, Galway Downs. And I went out to look at her, big, strong, beautiful thing. And the trainer says, hey, you should look at this filly next door, the Rahi filly. Well, I went over, and gosh, you could barely see over the webbing. She was so small. I said, no way. He said, watch her gallop. So I watched her, and she put her nose right on her chest, and she pulled this big guy around the track. So she was kind of a throw-in. So I talked to Mrs. Ritter about it. I don't want her. I said, come on, let's, this filly really impressed me. She's not that much money. She's really a throw-in. Well, the Flying Pacer filly never made it. And the Rahi filly went on to make like $800,000 and was a graded stakes winner, and she won her first two starts, the second start being the Landaloose.
Yeah, well, there you go. Sometimes those throw-in horses are a pretty good deal. You know,
that's the thing about training. You know, you have to be open-minded all the time. You have to go with your gut. I know you've probably heard that 100 times, but that's kind of what I try to teach the assistant trainers that I've had. That, you know, you see a horse, your first impression is usually the correct impression, and then your mind starts talking you out of it. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and usually that race that you have picked right off the bat is usually the right place to go, and then your mind starts working on you, you know?
Yeah.
And so I try to teach these guys to just go with their impression. What their first instinct is usually the right way to go. You've probably experienced that.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Well, you know, I said you were my first trainer, but you never saddled a horse for me. You put a kibosh on the horse that Jeff Siegel and I wanted to buy, And then by the next time we wanted to buy one, I had my trainer's license, so I trained it myself. But I still consider you my first trainer, because that horse that you turned down, he didn't turn out very good. You had the right idea there. So
good.
At least I never fired you.
Yeah, that's right. Never had the opportunity.
That's right. What about Dramatic Gold? He was a really nice horse. He won the Del Mar Breeders' Cup Handicap and the Buick Meadowlands Cup when that was a big race.
I'll tell you, he was one of the. He's still alive.
Is he really?
He's still out at Golden Eagle. Well, it's no longer Golden Eagle, but he still is turned out. He was a beautiful horse, but he was almost deformed. He was very bow-legged and back in the knee, which is not good, and he was a monster horse. He was a giant of a horse, heavy. So Mr. Maybe sent him in to me and said, get this horse ready to run and run him as cheap as you can, get rid of him. Okay. So I'm training him along. Boy, this horse is pretty nice. So I called Mr. Maybe and I say, hey, this horse is ready to run. He said, well, running for maiden 25. I said, no way. I said, this is really a good horse. I don't want to run him for a tag. You're crazy. Triple up horse. I don't want that horse. I said, listen, I'll give you $75,000 for him. So John says, if you think he's worth 75, he's got to be worth 200. I'm keeping him. So I go on to run him, and from then on, he made $3 million. And he was a horse, wherever he went, people fell in love with him. As soon as you were exposed to him, you fell in love with this horse. He had an aura about him that made you just love him. Everybody loved him. He is the reason. Well, he's not the reason, but he beat Alphabet Soup in the Del Mar Handicap. I had two horses in there, Alphabet Soup and Dramatic Gold. And Dramatic Gold beat Alphabet Soup that day.
So did you run 1-2? Is that how?
Yep.
Yeah.
Ran 1-2.
Very good.
Yeah. That was pretty exciting.
Another horse that a lot of people know, because he's turned out to be a very good sire, is Northern Affleet. And he was another horse, that very versatile horse.
Yeah, he was a wonderful horse. He was not a very sound horse, and he was kind of difficult to keep running. But boy, he tried every single time, and he would do anything. He would sprint or go long. Really an enjoyable horse, and I was so gratifying to see these horses turn out as being stallions, you know, when you're training them. To watch them, you feel like a grandfather, you know.
Yeah.
watching their offspring run. Yeah, he was really a nice horse. Vladimir Serin had him before I did, and had a falling out with the owners, and I ended up with Northern Affleet. So I got him, and he was pretty much already running, and he just got better with age, I think.
Yeah, well, he won the San Carlos, which is 7/8. He won the San Fernando Breeders' Cup Handicap, the San Diego Handicap. He was very versatile and a very classy horse.
Very, very nice horse.
You know, as I went through this list of your graded stakes winners, I noticed that you don't have a type. You train horses that win short, long, dirt, turf, fillies, colts, in town, out of town. What's your secret?
I don't know. I don't know what it is. People ask me that. What is your strength? And I think my strength is this. It doesn't matter what the age of the horse is or the distance or anything. If I have a goal, if I pick a specific race somewhere in the future, I'm very, very good at getting that horse to peak at that time. I think that's one of my strengths after looking back. But, you know, I had a couple guys come to me, and they said, I gave a seminar for the TLC, and these two guys came to me, and they said, we'd like to meet with you. I said, okay, why don't you come to my barn? So they showed up with a pad, and they had a list of questions on it. We said, well, we want to meet with you and see what your philosophy is on two-year-old racing and how you feel about three, you know, and I'm going, wait a minute, I'm too old for this. You know, so I said, I'll tell you what, you guys stay here in my tack room, and I'll go down and train this set, and we'll be back and we'll talk. Well, in my tack room, I have lots of pictures of, you know, of all the races, and they're on the walls and they're different things. So I got back and they said, I don't think we need to ask any questions. You seem to have answered them all just by not being here.
Very cagey of you.
Yeah, saves a lot of conversation.
That's great. Well, it is amazing. I mean, when you look at this list, because you know, a lot of times trainers get pigeonholed. Oh, he's a sprint trainer. Oh, you know, he trains horses for the grass or whatever. You know, and a lot of times it's not fair. Like I always talk about Christophe Clément. Everybody thinks he's a turf trainer. He's one of the best 2-year-old trainers in the country, and nobody knows it. You know, but stuff like that is crazy. But there's no, make no mistake about it, and these guys obviously were smart enough to pick up on it. Your resume includes horses of every ilk, and you ship and win. You can do all kinds of things with them, so there's got to be some talent there. One of my favorites, and maybe the closest you ever got to winning the Kentucky Derby, was with Millennium Wind, huh?
Yeah, he was a special horse. He was so talented. He was just raw talent. He was just powerful and fast and could carry it. He was fantastic. He was a wonderful horse.
Yeah, and
there's a horse we should talk about though, is Greg's Gold.
Yeah, Greg's Gold. Now I read in an article that Jay Privman wrote about you that you said that was the best training job you ever did.
Yeah. Well, the poor horse was compromised with a bowed tendon. And you know, we did the stem cell and brought him back. I want to say this about him. The trainer that had him before me was Howie Zucker. Now, this horse was by a turf sire out of a turf mare and looked like a turf horse. Tall, rangy, long, you know, and he just looked like it. So Howie got him ready to run and ran him long the first time, and he ran horrible. So the owner got mad and fired him. So I have this horse in training now, and I'm going, well, Howie did the right thing. This horse is a turf horse. Look at him. Look at the quick turn of foot. This horse has got to run on the turf. Howie did the right thing here. The guy is wrong, you know? So I say, I'm going to sprint him first, put a race in him, and then I'll run him down the hill. Well, I sprinted him the first time, and he ran second, ran 8 and change, and he almost won. I'm like, where in the hell did this come from? You know? And he just turned into he didn't like the turf, and he didn't like an off track. But, man, he was one of the fastest horses I ever trained. He ran 107 and change once.
Wow.
And that, I think that was after he had a bowed tendon.
Wow. Well, he won.
He was. Go ahead.
He won the Pat O'Brien and the Potrero Grande, so he had to have some speed. To win those races in California, you got to be a fast horse.
Oh, yeah. He was very, very, very fast. Yeah. Couldn't route, though.
Yeah. Well, that's like, can't do everything.
Right.
You had a nice 2-year-old a couple years ago, JP's Gusto. Talk about him a little bit.
He was a wonderful horse. He was one of the kindest, nicest horses. Probably, all you had to do was stay out of his way. He was just like a smaller version of Awesome Again. Awesome Again trained himself. This colt trained himself. All you had to do was just don't interfere. You know, just let him go out there, breeze him with another horse. He's going to beat him. He's going to go fast enough. Enter him in, and they both of them would run through a brick wall. And that was him. He was the kind of a horse that just wanted to do it all the time. He wanted to win all the time. He was really great.
Yeah, he won the Hollywood Juvenile Championship at Grade 3, the Best Pal at Grade 2, and the Del Mar Futurity at Grade 1. So he had one in every category, and he was a super solid horse.
He broke his maiden in a stake. I ran him in a maiden race, and he got left and finished fourth, and I ran him back in the Willard Proctor, and he won that at Hollywood, and then he won the Hollywood. Was it the Futurity?
The Hollywood Juvenile Championship.
Juvenile Championship.
And then he won the Del Mar Futurity. I guess that's later on. That's the summer summer race.
He ran at Del Mar. He won the two stakes. I think I ran him in the Best Pal.
And then the
Futurity. He won them both.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was good. He was really really good horse. I've been pretty lucky. real lucky to have these nice horses.
Yeah.
It's been wonderful.
Well, the pictures on the wall get you some more clients. That's what happens.
Yeah, we just need clients.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's what everybody needs, clients. But you've had some good ones. Speaking of good clients, the Ammermans had Balance with you, and boy, was she something else.
Balance was amazing. She was like Cat's Cradle. She was kind of a really tough horse to handle and to be around. She was very unpredictable, and you had to be very careful training her, and the groom had to be very careful grooming her. I remember I had Victor Espinosa come out and work her one morning, and I said, "Now stay behind this other horse about four or five lengths. When you turn in the lane, just ask to still you run a little bit and see what happens." And so I'm watching the work, and she's four or five lengths, and next thing I know, she's head and head with the horse. Victor came back and said, "I don't know what happened." He said, "I moved my hands, and the next thing I knew, I was alongside that other horse." that's how much she could accelerate.
Well, she's...
And then I thought she was real good, and then when Zenyatta came along and had her first start, I thought, well, that's Balance's little sister. Then Zenyatta came along and won her next start, and I said, uh-oh, I think it's Balance is Zenyatta's sister.
That's true. Although Balance, you know, I mean, she won three grade ones or two grade ones, three grade ones. She won the Las Virginis, she won the Sanita mm-hmm. Oaks, and she won the La Cañada, which was a grade two. So,
right.
But
she was very good. She could sprint and route. I remember her first start, she won with Garrett Gomez, and then Victor rode her in her second start, and he came on across the dirt. He reached down to hit her left-handed, and she ducked in, and she won the stake. It was a stake. She won that, and they disqualified her.
Yeah, brutal.
Yeah. So she was awesome. She was something big and not very tall because she was by Thunder Gulch, but very, very strong. The mare herself, the mother, is big and massive and very bull-like. You know, I guess that's where Zenyatta gets all that growth, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break to pay the bills, and we'll be back with Dave Hoffman's on Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton. This is the Horse Racing Radio Network.
For your best chance at success, shop Fasig Tipton Selected Sales. Annually ranked at the top of all major North American sales by percentage of Grade 1 winners and graded stakes winners produced, that trend continued at the 2015 Breeders' Cup World Championships. Fasig Tipton Selected Sales grads won six Breeders' Cup races at Keeneland, with victories by such stars as American Pharoah, Stop Charging Maria, Songbird, Nyquist, Teppan, and Waybell Avenue. Fasig Tipton Selected Sales. Where will you be? For more information, please visit FasigTipton.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Mayan, one of the nation of class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York, the premier state-bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Kale Density announces a revolutionary gastrointestinal guard and aid for all classes and all ages of horses. A natural registered animal feed product, it comes as a single dose disposable syringe or a handy top dress squeeze pouch. Field trials on Kale Density Digestive Aid have returned 100% favorable results as observed by their trainers and owners, and the cost is half of what horsemen are accustomed to paying. Kale Density Digestive Aid will be available in mid-November, or you can order online at kaledensity.com. Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
This is David Cohen.
This is Gary Siaka.
This is David Jacobson.
This is Gary Gallo.
This is Bruce Brown, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And Silver Charm has taken the lead as the field approaches the top of the stretch, but his arch rival Freehouse is right there to his outside. The stage is set. Touch Gold swings into action on the far outside. They're at the top of the stretch. It is Silver Charm, unwavering, holding on tenaciously to the lead. Freehouse is right there with him. Touch Gold driving on the outside in the final furlong. Silver Charm holding the lead. Here comes Touch Gold and Freehouse. Silver Charm has lost the lead, and Touch Gold will deny him the crown by a heartbreaking half length.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld in Horse Racing Radio Network's Lexington, Kentucky studio, and we're shooting the breeze with David Hoffmans. Just a reminder, if you missed any part of this show or you want to listen to it again, you can access our archives at horseracingradio.net or Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Dave, that was some Belmont Stakes effort by Touch Gold. That's a bucket list race for most people. Talk about that experience.
Well, that was very gratifying, because when he won the Lexington Stakes at Keeneland, before that, Gary Stevens rode him. He came back and he said, you know, this could be a better horse than Silver Charm, he said. And so we met with the Stronach group, and they wanted to run in the Derby, and I didn't, because I thought it was too soon back. It was only 2 weeks. And Touch Gold was a really nice racehorse, really good racehorse, but you had to train him like a filly. If you did one thing too much, you'd stop eating. You had to really monitor him and be very careful on how you trained him. And so I was against running him in the Derby, which in hindsight might have been a mistake. But anyway, I didn't run him. We ran in the Preakness. He fell on his head leaving Preakness and grabbed a quarter really badly. He tore a quarter of his hoof off. So we fixed that up, and we got him in the Belmont. And I remember watching the race, and I saw Chris. He broke on top, and he was kind of in front. And then all of a sudden, I saw Chris anchor him back and take him back and let Silver Charm and Freehouse go. And I thought, uh-oh, I hope that's not a mistake. But he knew what he was doing, and he came flying the last part. And I wasn't sure he was going to get there. And but he was really running the last part. It was really, really an exciting race for me. It was a little difficult because there were so many people there wanting Silver Charm to win the Belmont. You're in New York. It was a little scary. We were booed, you know, but I loved it.
Well, yeah, it's always interesting. We've had several runs at the Triple Crown recently, mm-hmm. and I've been there for several of them. And, you know, one of the races that I'll never forget is Smarty Jones, and he opened up, and it looked like he was home free, and people went wild. And then here comes Birdstone and beats him on the wire, and the place went right. from, like, the loudest crowd I'd ever heard in my life to almost like a mortuary. It was absolutely yeah. silent. And it was uh-huh. the strangest feeling to have that, you know, the difference was so palpable that mm-hmm. I'll never forget it. And, you know, mm-hmm. there's been quite a few horses get nipped out of the Triple Crown. But it's interesting to hear you say with gusto that you really loved that experience.
Oh, yeah, I did. You know, because I have a feeling about that. The Triple Crown is definitely for a champion horse. And if you're the champion, you've got to beat everybody that's around. And you can't pat it. You can't say, well, he didn't run in the Preakness, so he can't run in the thing. I think it's the guy that wins the Triple Crown deserves to be the overwhelming champion, and he has to earn it.
Yeah, let's get off of the subject here for just a second, because this is an interesting conversation. But what was your general impression of American Pharoah as you were watching him train? Did you get to see him much out there?
Oh, yeah. I watched him. I clocked him a lot. He was fantastic. He just developed as the year went on. He just got stronger, and he got faster, and he got doing things much easier. His work before the Breeders' Cup was unbelievable. I mean, he was in a high lope. He was just loping along there, and he went the last 8 and 10 and change, just nothing. You know, I watched him develop as he came along, and he was the best of a generation, that's for sure.
Yeah, so there's no doubt in your mind that he was a deserved champion for sure.
No, none whatsoever.
Well, when Sid Craig, Jenny Craig's husband, won the Epsom Derby with Dr. Devious, he said he had no idea what a big deal it was. And we mentioned it. that's what he said. I had no idea it was such a big deal. We mentioned at the top of the show that you won the Queen's Plate with Awesome Again, and that's a race that's steeped in history and tradition and one mm-hmm. that every Canadian owner and trainer covets. What was that like?
That was unbelievable because the Queen was there. It was the first time in 20 years, and she showed up. And that was even an added treat. But like I said before, Awesome Again trains himself. He won a 7/8 race, and it went right into the Queen's Plate off of that. You know, I think it was either 1.8 or 1.25. I don't remember. But that was a really good horse. That was quite an experience there to win that race, and with the Queen being there and able to meet her and showcase this horse on a really good career that he ended up having.
Well, you must have a picture with the Queen in your office.
Oh,
huh?
Of course I do. I tell everyone that's my ex-wife.
And don't you wish?
Yeah. And some people say, gee, she actually looks like the Queen of England. Oh, really?
That's a classic. That's typical Dave Hoffman's right there. Well, that was quite an event, and I mean, just a fantastic thing. Was that Mr. Stronach's first Queen's Plate? Or?
You know, I think it was. I think it was his first Queen's Plate. I believe it was.
Yeah, yeah. That's a
and his son got married the next day.
Oh wow!
So that was kind of a big weekend for him.
Yeah, I guess so. Never one to miss out on a party, Mr. Stronach. The best party giver right. since Marjorie L. Everett, I have to say.
Yeah.
but yeah, that's just an awesome experience to have. And I didn't know that the Queen was actually there. She must have found out you were running the horse and showed up.
I think that's why she booked the flight over.
Yeah, her mom probably sent out quite a hefty wager, too.
So.
In case you've popped in late, we're here with David Hoffman's on Trainer Talk, sponsored by Fasig Tipton. Here's one you're going to like, Dave.
Cigar trying to get him as they reach the top of the stretch. Moe Katoras and Alphabet Soup fighting ungainly. Mont Sassafras clinging desperately to the lead. Alphabet Soup in with an upset chance. Cigar, the heart of it champion, trying to get him. It's Alphabet Soup. Cigar on the outside. Moe Katoras. Alphabet Soup has scored a
shocking upset. Cigar has been denied another victory in the Breeders' Cup Classic. There they are as they came under the line, and it was Alphabet Soup and Chris McCarron. A brilliant ride today. Cigar was hung up wide the whole way. I am sure that was the winning difference this afternoon.
Well, it's a small club of trainers that can say they beat the incomparable, invincible, unbeatable Cigar, but you did it. That had to be very special.
It was special. I'll tell you, I'll start with a couple of days before the race. We went up to Canada. We were there and Toronto. And I had Dramatic Gold in the race also. So I was schooling both horses, and it was in the afternoon. And we took Alphabet Soup. The groom took him and put him in the stall and turned. And when he turned, his head went up. And it was like a light bulb went on. Something changed in him. From that, that was on, I think we ran on a Saturday, and that was on a Thursday. It was either Sunday race, Friday, but whatever. It was the day and a half before. From that moment on, his whole demeanor changed. He didn't want to play. He didn't want to mess around. All he wanted to do was march to the track, train, and march back home. I mean, he was like, he knew what was going on, and he was determined. And that's one thing that Chris and I talked about. We talked about, you know, this little guy is so determined. And Chris said, you know, if I can get his head out inside the quarter pole, if I can get his head in front, he might not let these guys get by him. You know, and so sure enough, that's the way Chris rode him. And I'm watching Cigar the whole race. I see Alphabet Soup where he is, but I'm watching Cigar the whole way. So when they come off the turn and they straighten out the stretch, Alphabet Soup takes the lead. He pokes his head about a half length in front. And I'm thinking, God, hold on, little guy. Hold on, because he was a small horse. Hold on, little guy. And I'm watching Cigar, and Cigar's coming on the outside. He's coming. Boom. And I think we win by a long neck, half length, you know. And I said, come on, Mrs. Ritter, let's go down to the woods. She said, no, I'm not going. I don't think we won. I said, yeah, we won by half a length, maybe a neck, but we won. Come on down to the winner's circle. Nope. Not coming down until the photo comes up. I don't think we won. Well, the photo comes up. Alphabet Soup, Louis Couturier's Cigar. I never saw Louis Couturier's on the inside. We won by a nose. I never saw him at all.
Now you know how the jocks feel when they don't see those horses coming.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a great story.
That was quite an experience beating Cigar at that. And, you know, they were saying, well, Cigar's a step off. He's not what he was. But, hell, they broke the track record.
Yeah.
He broke the track record, and it held for a long, long time. So, you know, so I don't listen to those people that say Cigar wasn't as good. He probably wasn't as good as he was when he was younger, but he still was a pretty damn good horse.
Yeah, no question about it.
You know, and that's what I mean about Alphabet Soup. Let me tell you another story about him. I ran him at Santa Anita, and Chris Antley rode him. And Richard Mandela had a horse called Soul of the Matter in there. They're turning into the stretch. Soul of the Matter's in front. Alphabet Soup's coming. Soul of the Matter's in front at the 8th pole. At the 16th pole, Trevor Dedman says, and Soul of the Matter is drawing away. And the next thing you see is this silver flash or gray flash come and nail him at the wire. So, and beat him by a nose. Gary Stevens rode Soul of the Matter. So I go down there, and Antley's coming back, and he's crying. You know, Antley cried a lot. Anyway, he said, Dave, I didn't do this. He said, this horse literally threw himself at the finish line at that horse to beat him. He said he's amazing. And that was Alphabet Soup. He just gave it to you. He gave it to you no matter what you try to do. He beat Leeches just, he's sprinting. And then he goes on and beats Cigar in the mile and a quarter, you know?
Yeah.
I was in a little bit of a little teeny bit of where I was going to run. I was either going to run in the sprint or the mile and a quarter. And I thought, people are going to think I'm crazy. I entered in both races. And what am I going to do, run three quarters or a mile and a quarter, you know?
So, you entered in both races.
Yeah,
you might be the only person that's ever entered in the sprint and the classic. That you might have that distinction. That's
I did. I thought, people are going to think I'm nuts. This guy doesn't know anything.
The only other horse I would think would even possibly think about that would be Precisionist, huh?
Probably. Yeah, you would think.
He would be that kind of a horse.
Well, I thought Leech's Deceased was going to be the favorite, and we just beat him. Uh-huh. So I thought, well, what the hell?
That's great. That's mm-hmm. fantastic. Well, yeah, you've talked quite a bit about Chris McCarron and Chris Antley, mm-hmm. but two jocks that obviously have done nothing but good for you. How does that work in your experience? The riders that you choose for the horses, or do you just like to stick with the guys you're lucky with?
No, well, somewhat guys you're lucky with, but you know it's. Chris McCarron could write anything, you know, and so I've always tried to get Chris first, and if he was taken or couldn't write for us for some reason, then I'd go in another direction. But I like pretty much all the jocks. I think all the jocks now are pretty qualified and they all ride well. I'm pretty loyal. When a guy rides a horse, he usually gets to ride him back several times, you know?
Yeah.
That's about it. And I thought Chris Antley was a great rider. It was too bad he had so many emotional problems, you know? But, and I just look for, you know, the Eddie Delahousies, which there aren't anymore. But that's it. I look for guys that are comfortable on horses and patient, probably. Patience may be the thing I look for most.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always tell people I feel lucky to be a part of that, what I call the last golden age of racing. I mean, when mm-hmm. all the Hall of Fame trainers were at Santa Anita, Laz Barrera, Charlie Whittingham, Bobby Frankel, I mean, now Gary Jones, Farrell Jones, Gary Jones' dad. I mean, these guys are you know, legends in our sport. Buster Milrick, mm-hmm. Willard Proctor. It doesn't seem like it's the same depth and the riders. It used to be like you know, the top 10 riders, the worst guy in the top 10 list would be the leading rider at any other racetrack in the country. I mean,
right.
It was really a special time.
It sure was. We had everything. I mean, we had weather, we had purses, and we had the audience, and it was the sport of choice at that time. And now it's unfortunately has changed with all these different entertainment options that people have, and the younger generation is not that interested in horse racing as much as my generation was or your generation is. And so that's unfortunate, but I do feel fortunate that I was a part of that, watching those great horsemen and those horses run and watching these guys do their craft. It was a wonderful, wonderful time for me. I have to talk about one horse, though, before we get off the air, and that's a horse that I had. You'll know him. His name is His Legacy. And His Legacy was a cowbred, kind of a little cheap horse that Pete Perella owned, Legacy Ranch. And he won. I won with him at 2 and I won with him at 10. And he won a bunch of races in between. Well, his last race was the mile and a half, I think it was, California Starters race, the stake. So he won it. He was second the year before, and he won it the 2 years before that. So he's coming down the stretch, and he's going to win. Paul Atkinson's riding him, and he's going to win. And I stand up, and I turn, and there's Grant standing there next to me, and we're both crying. Mm-hmm. And this old horse of ours is coming down the lane. That is one of my most favorite horses, one of my most favorite races was his last race at Santa Anita. That was quite a thing.
That's fantastic. It's a tribute to your program that you started out with a horse at 2 and continued his career until the age of 10, and he goes out a winner. People sometimes don't realize how close trainers get to their horses, and a lot of times trainers, you know, take flack and people say unkind things, but I think 95% of trainers really, really love their horses.
Well, you know, they do, and you have to be dedicated to be in this business. The most lazy trainer gets there at 6:30 in the morning, come on.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And most people aren't even out of bed yet.
Yeah.
Guys are working. Yeah. You know, you really have to be dedicated to be in this game and find some gratification from it. And, it's we like to criticize guys, but, man, I'm telling you, there's a bunch of hardworking. Well, you know, you've experienced it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a lifestyle. It's something that you do, and I haven't saddled a horse since the year 2000, but I still get up at 4:30 every morning. My clock genes are so good. I don't even need to set an alarm. I'm up, yeah. I do more work before 10 o'clock than most people do all day. So
yeah, my day off, I get up. I can't stay in bed later than 7:30. I just wake up. It's impossible.
Yeah.
And I try. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really difficult. Well, you talked about your son Grant, and you know, you've had tremendous success in our sport, but there's more to life than horse racing. Talk about your family a little bit and how what they have brought to your training career.
Well, I have two daughters and a son. My son Grant is in the business. My daughters are not. They both have two children each, so I have six grandchildren, and very proud and happy with that. And Grant is training in Kentucky now, and he was a big help to me. He was my assistant trainer for many years. And my family has always been in support of what you, and that's so important for a horse trainer because it's so demanding on a family. You know, the days you can't go to Disneyland, the day you can't take the kids here, you've got to miss a birthday, you've got to miss something. You know, we all go through that in this business because our business is entertaining other people who have Saturdays and Sundays off and holidays off, and we have to work. So our kids suffer from that. And that was a hard thing, but we managed to do it, and the kids were good. And so I've had a really good life, and I have great grandchildren to mess with, and that's where I am. I'm married now to a woman named Linda. She's Linda McCoy Murray. She's Jim Murray, the old sports writer's widow, and she has her foundation, the Jim Murray Memorial Foundation, that she runs, and we live here in Arcadia, close to the track, so life is good.
That's fantastic. It's great to hear. It is rough on trainers, and hopefully their kids take a liking to be around the barn, be at the track a little bit, and enjoy that part about it. I know my kids used to like the fact that I was off on Mondays and Tuesdays, but
yeah,
you know, it's not your standard family operation. You're not mowing the lawn on Saturday, and I never looked at it that way before. But when you mentioned, you know, that the owners have Saturdays and Sundays off, it's almost like a trainer's partially in the hospitality business. I mean, you are at the track.
Yeah.
You're entertaining your clients. You're making sure everybody has a box seat. Everybody's got a sandwich. Anybody needs a drink. You're part of the job is being a waiter.
Right.
You know,
an underpaid waiter.
Yeah, with no tips.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a very unique lifestyle, and it really does help if your family is supportive, and mm-hmm. if your kids enjoy it as much as you do. And I think all trainers that appear on this program say they wish their kids didn't become trainers, but I think they're also very happy that the kids enjoyed going to the track and did things a little differently. I mean, none of the kids ever complained by going to Del Mar every summer, did they?
Right. No, never. Yeah. And, you know, and they grew up with a little better sense of animals, too. And you know, when you were around animals, especially horses, they're so you learn how to be. You learn how to be kinder, I think, with people and everything. I think that's the thing that's missing in our cities. These kids never see an animal. They don't touch an animal, you know. And my children got to pet the horses and hug on them and love on them, and the horses would love them back. So they got something there, you know. You get something. And I think that's kind of missing in our society, that kids are just raised in an apartment and they never see an animal. You know, they have to go to the zoo to see something.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's, you know, L.A. guys like us, we never really got to see any horses unless we went to the track.
That's right.
So
that's exactly right.
That's kind of where I got my I loved horses. I used to, you know, watch Roy Rogers and Hopalong Cassidy and all that stuff. And I loved horses, but the only time I ever got to see him is when my dad or my uncle would take me to the races. So that's kind of where it came from for me. But
me too.
I mentioned earlier that you're a wine aficionado, and what's your favorite your current favorite wine? What are you drinking now?
Well, I've been drinking Camus wine for the last 20 years, and I can't change. I mean, it's not the best wine, but it's good for me, and I like it. It's a Camus Cabernet and Sauvignon, Cabernet Sauvignon, and it's what I drink. That, and I've switched over from Belvedere to Tito Vodka.
Oh, and Tito's is a sponsor of the Horse Racing Radio Network. So on behalf of Tito's Vodka.
On board. That is wonderful stuff.
Yeah, it really is good. You keep it in the freezer?
I do.
Yeah, it has that velvety viscosity. We actually had the guy on Tito's, the guy from Tito's that runs their advertising program was on last Saturday on our Equine Forum show talking about the Mongolian guys that won with Mongolian Saturday in the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. And they were kind of teasing him about Tito's vodka and Russian vodka back and forth, but I think he sold them on the Tito's vodka idea.
It's very, very nice.
That's pretty good. Well, it's a question we always like to ask kind of towards the end of the show. What else does Dave Hoffmans like to do when he's not at the track?
Well, I like a couple of things. I do play a little teeny bit of golf, not much, mostly executive stuff. I like going to casino and gamble. We have Indian casinos here now, and I like going and playing Texas Hold'em for a little bit, and I like hanging out with my grandkids. Mostly I like hanging out with them and trying to teach them about life subtly. and that's about it. That's what I did.
Well, that's
you know, racetrackers, right? We don't do too much.
Yeah, well, that's a good grouping of things. You've always handled training horses with aplomb, and you've also managed to have a little bit of a life alongside this tremendous career that you've put together. So it's good to hear that you get out and hang out with the kids a little bit and do some things you enjoy doing. Well, it's been unbelievable, Dave. I mean, this hour's flown by, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share some of your greatest hits with us today on Trainer Talk.
Well, I want to thank you, Jude, and thank you for all you've done in the industry. So I think it's a better place because of you, and I hope to see you soon.
I appreciate that, and I want to remind everybody out there, if you missed any part of this show, you can access it on our archives at horseracingradio.net. or on Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Many thanks to Fasic Tipton for sponsoring this program. And for our producer, Lee Delapina, this is Jude Feld on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Thanks for listening.